I don't know why the lectionary divides our gospel as it does today. The lectionary has us reading an answer. The answer, God so loved the world that God gave his only son. It's an answer to a question that is raised a few verses earlier. So what we've got is an answer without including the question. First, therefore, here's the question, for which John 3, 14 through 17 is an answer. A smart man named Nicodemus comes to Jesus by night, and he has a question. How can anyone be born after having grown old? How is it possible to, can you enter a second time into your mother's womb and be born again? It's an interesting question, Nicodemus's question. It is an inquiry into the possibility of starting over, becoming fresh, new, changed, reborn. It's a curious question for an old man to ask. Or maybe it's the only question old men ought ever to ask. How is it possible to start over? How is it possible to be youthful again, to lay aside all of the bad old things I've done and all of the bad old things that have been done to me? How is it possible to begin again, fresh, to be recreated? I think one ought to cultivate such questions. Here is the answer. Just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. For God so loved the world that God gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but may have eternal life. Indeed, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Something happens to the eyes of a child sometime between, I'd say, 5 and 10 years of age. I blame it on the brutality of school, but I could be wrong. Who dulled those bright 5-year-old eyes? Who stifled the questions, the incessant questions of a 4-year-old? Now, I think those of you who are young will agree with me when I say that you are better off than I. You're young. You're beginning. I am old. I am ending. You are summer. I am fall. Everything about you still works. You are yet green. Of me and my tribe, the poet Yeats said in his poem, The Scholars, bald heads forgetful of their sins, old, learned, respectable bald heads edit and annotate the lines that young men tossing on their beds rhymed out in love's despair to flatter beauty's ignorant ear. All shuffle there, all cough in ink, all wear the carpet with their shoes, all think what other people think. I have shuffled there. When I write these days, I live off of yesterday's love's despair that once was typical sophomoric speech. I sleep soundly, unlike the youth tossing on their beds. I cough up a great deal of ink, and mostly think as others think. And that is the real curse of old age. And I don't care what Bob Dole says in the commercial. Thus the poet John Crow Ransom advises young girls in school, go listen to your teachers, old and contrary. Please do not believe a word. And that's not bad advice for the young. I thus urge you who are still young to cultivate skepticism. Pay not too close attention to old words of old people, maybe even mine. I can tell just by looking at some of you into your eyes that some of you are quite good at not being too respectful of old people. And that's good, not only because we're sucking away your Social Security, but also because old, learned, respectable, bald heads, suffering as we do from short-term memory loss of our youthful sin, tend to be less knowledgeable of the world than we claim. And you are smarter in your youthful ignorance than you let on. The truth of things is so thick, so not easily stated, elusive of our desire to understand. I think you got to keep cultivating an unconvinced deportment. Not cynicism, which seems to be your generation's particular fault, that Beavis and Butthead MTV smartassness. Cynicism is just a mask for a failure to think deeply. Cynicism is being smart enough to know that something is not right, but knows not how nor cares not enough to think it through. No, make skepticism your goal. Fortunately, the truth of things, all the way down deep, is so elusive, mysterious, thick. It has a way of keeps beckoning us, alluring us, seducing us to think. Despite that cultivated kind of cynicism that says, there's no use for the bear to go up the mountain to look over on the other side because when he does, there's really nothing on the other side. No, the great thing is that the sheer weirdness of the world makes us drop cynical defenses and keeps making us go take a look for ourselves. And I want you to keep cultivating that. I want you to keep doing the Nicodemus thing of, well, how can this be, Jesus? How? Alas, too much of liberal arts education is anything but liberal or even art. We teachers present ourselves as if we know something for sure. And we'll tell you what we know. And you write it down and then you spit it back on the midterm. No, absolute certitude about anything is ought to be rare. We tend to bed down with facts, what we know for sure, far too soon in the journey. Maybe it's because I'm paid to think about God, who is so much more interesting, say, than psychology or French history. But I fear that what we call higher education is just encouragement to give up the fight way too soon, to cut our intellectual losses, to grab a few facts that we've assembled, and then leave the table long before the game gets good. We become far too easily pleased with what we know and apathetic over what we don't know. And this is our great defeat. When Augustine was checking out the Christian faith, he tried reading the Bible. And frankly, Augustine was unimpressed. Augustine had been the beneficiary of the very best of a classical liberal arts education. He had read great literature like Virgil and Cicero and Livy. And Augustine knew instantly the Bible is not great literature. He complained to Ambrose of Milan about the inferiority of the Bible's way of doing things. Ambrose told him, "You silly little pedant, you have not the skills for reading the Bible. When you read the Bible, you read something like fish, and you erroneously think fish. Or you read about bread, and you start thinking about bread and nothing else. No. In the Bible, everyday things keep being transformed. They become signs, sacraments of deeper, thicker, richer truth." And Augustine said when he heard that, it was as if his ears got unstopped. A new world opened. Not long after that, lounging one afternoon in a garden, Augustine heard a child singing a little rhyme. "Take up and read, take up and read." Augustine wasn't sure. Was it a child or an angel? By this point, under the tutelage of Ambrose, he was highly suggestive. He picked up the closest thing at hand. It was a codex of Paul's letter to the Romans. He flopped it open and he read, and he said his whole life was reconstituted. His eyes and ears were opened, and he knew. Oh, I wish I could get you to develop that kind of deportment, that willingness, that Augustinian expectation, that Bible-engendered intellectual eagerness to be surprised by words. People often say Christianity is a revealed religion. A revealed religion. What we mean by that is that it's not self-evident. You're not born with it. It's got to be revealed to you. It's got to come as a gift. It's got to come as some kind of word from the outside. During a discussion last year on ethics, a graduate student lectured us. "Well, we are learning that there is a certain genetic disposition to certain kinds of adaptively beneficial behavior. And you see, what you call ethics is only that sum of behavior which has been genetically programmed into the human race." I thought it sad that on some April evening in the Duke Gardens, a young man might look into the eyes of a young woman and say sweetly, "I have a genetic propensity for you. And I feel that together we could strengthen the gene pool of the race." Oh, modernity. Modernity, that narrow point of view engendered into us by the Enlightenment. Modernity is always saying, "Well, things are only this," or "they're just that." I want you to take that word "only" as a tip-off, that whenever you hear it, you're going to hear some reductionistic account of reality that falsifies the very stuff it's supposed to be describing. All right, sometimes I confess I teach as if I were preparing students to be contestants on Jeopardy or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Here's the answer. Now memorize it and repeat it. Protagoras, that 5th century sophist, declared, "Man is the measure of everything." No, because that confuses the measure with the measurer. Truth always precedes our knowing truth. Life has got more meaning than I would ever be able to tell. You are not, for all of your intellectual achievements, God. And I think to keep appreciating the limits of our knowing, to keep working that distance between the knower and the known, that is wisdom. Curiosity is close cousin of humility. And that, I think, explains why fresh persons can be embarrassingly more interesting than seniors. I had a class once read Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled. There, the psychotherapist Peck implies that some people in this society are sick because they're sick not because of something, some childhood trauma, not because of some inner psychic distress. They're just sick because they're intellectually lazy. When confronted by life's very predictable crises, they dig in. They stick with the accustomed routine. They keep working what once worked. They don't take the trouble, the effort, the risk to investigate, to rethink. Peck says reality takes a constant dedication. Work. That's one reason we make you read like poems of Yeats, or we make you do Shakespeare. Because, well, frankly, nobody needs this stuff at 20. But the trouble is, there's hardly anybody who can live after 50 without it. Because one day you're going to need to have a reason to go on. And you'll know where to go when you need a reason just to make it through the night. I know you've been told that curiosity killed the cat. But here at midlife, I can count lots of dead cats who died for lack of curiosity, not because of it. Old Nicodemus came to Jesus in the dark. He comes in the dark to Mr. Light. And he asks, how can this be? How is it possible to be reborn? You climb into your mother's womb, you start all over like an infant. How can you begin again? How? Jesus, as is typical of Jesus in the Gospel of John, responds with enigmatic talk about wind and spirit and light and truth. How? Says Nicodemus. I don't get it. Jesus says, you're beginning to get it. Rebirth, new life, light is possible in our darkness, not because of our earnest scholarly investigation, but because of the incursions of a God who loves. We got a God, says the rest of John's gospel, who loves you and the world enough to reveal, to be lifted up so you can see him. The answer to our questions is before us as light. We shall know. Now we see through a glass darkly, but one day it will be like being face to face. Not as the result of our earnest intellectual inquiry, but rather as a gift of a God who refuses to leave you in the dark. The answer to our best questions has got a name, has got a face. Jesus. To know him is to be known and to know. Proust writes that much of life is like walking down a dark, deserted nighttime street, and you're all alone, and you try this door, and then you try that door, but all of them are locked, all secured against entry, but you keep trying, you keep walking, you keep trying each doorknob until you come before a door that opens to you of its own accord, and you go in, and you know. Keep knocking on the doors And I promise it shall be opened unto you. How? How can this be? I'll tell you. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son so that we might have life.